Hey, Ryan Reynolds here. Wishing you a very happy half-off holiday because right now, Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So, that means a half day, yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes of networks busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Joining us on the line now is Jay Margolese. He's a New York Times best-selling author who's written various books about Marilyn Monroe. He appeared in the 2014 documentary The Missing Evidence, The Death of Marilyn Monroe. He's the co-author of My Marilyn, along with Terry Carger, who is a child of Hollywood. She's the granddaughter of Metro Pictures co-founder Maxwell Carger and the daughter of Fred Carger, a vocal coach at Columbia Pictures. Terry's story revolves around Fred and a trio of silver screen legends, her stepmother Jane Wyman, Ronald Reagan, and primarily Marilyn Monroe. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Hey, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us. And what an amazing story. How did you and Terry come together to tell this story?
Well, I was doing interviews for my second book, the New York Times bestseller called The Murder of Marilyn Monroe, Case Closed. And she never thought about writing a book before, and because she never wanted to think that anyone wanted to think she was going to profit from doing something like this. She knew Marilyn as a softer, more intelligent person than was portrayed on screen. And she thought it was very unfortunate that this dumb blonde image that the studio portrayed, because it made them box office hits like The 7 Year Itch and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, but they just didn't really want to show the real Marilyn. And so, she had a talk with her stepbrother, Michael Reagan, because her father, when Terry was 11, had married Jane Wyman, who had won an Academy Award for the Oscar for Johnny Belinda. And then at that point, Jane had been divorced from Ronald Reagan, so Michael and Maureen Reagan became her stepbrother and stepsister. So, even to this day, Michael, who wrote the foreword for this book, they communicate, they go on trips with their husbands and wives. And because, Colleen, Michael's wife, is a travel agent. And so one day Michael was talking with Terry and said, hey, you should write a book about the real Marilyn, because, all this, stuff has been written about her that's untrue. And you'd really get to show the real story behind Marilyn Monroe. And so I started to push Terry on that concept, because at first she was, didn't want to write the book. But then I said to her, why don't you write it? I'll help you write it. And she eventually agreed, because she wanted people to see who she was behind the image. And it was something that hardly anybody knew about.
That must be so weird and difficult and heartbreaking to know someone and know someone really well, but see the whole portrayal of them in the media and on screen be completely different. That must be very difficult.
Oh, it is, because, Terry met Marilyn when Terry was 6 years old, and Marilyn was her babysitter. Imagine your first and only babysitter being Marilyn Monroe. But of course, during that time, it was 1948, Marilyn hadn't yet, become a big star yet. She was still a contract player under Columbia Pictures, and Terry's father was Marilyn's vocal coach, and really taught her how to beautifully sing for Ladies of the Chorus. And you hear her sing in that movie, it's really beautiful. And that's all, Fred's work there helping Marilyn. And, so she knew her before she was famous. So she knew what she was like, behind the curtains, behind the scenes. And then when she saw her rise to stardom, she felt nothing but gratitude for Marilyn. She's like, oh, well, I knew her before she became famous. And she knew her for 14 years, almost 15 years. And Terry's grandmother, Nana, Ann Conley, actually became like a mother to Marilyn, because when Marilyn was 7, her mother was in an institution. And so this woman, Terry's grandmother, became this mother for the rest of Marilyn's life. And it's something that not a lot of people know about. In fact, there was a charm bracelet that Marilyn gave Nana in 1953 that said, to Ann with my deepest love and friendship, Marilyn. And that was a 14 karat gold charm bracelet. Imagine in 1953 money, how much that would have cost.
Wow. Yes. So what did Terry say about Marilyn and what she remembers about what she was like growing up?
Well, she remembers that she loved children, and she later learned that, you know, adults were very mean to her. You know, that women would talk behind her back on the movie set and would say horrible things. And, you know, Marilyn says, well, I know I could always trust you and you'd never betray me. And Terry says, well, of course I wouldn't betray you because, you know, children, you know, don't have those kind of vindictive thoughts. You know, and so Marilyn felt very comfortable around Terry and saw her as like a little sister, sometimes like a daughter, and Marilyn was like a surrogate mother, big sister. And so, you know, Marilyn felt really comfortable around Terry's family because Terry's family already grew up knowing a lot of people in the movie business. Jack Lemmon was Terry's father's best friend. And, you know, it was they were golfing buddies. There's a picture of them two together on a movie set that we have in the book. And her father, Fred, went out with a number of screen actresses like Kim Novak and Rita Hayworth. Wow. And so all this fame was normal to Terry. So she didn't get all, you know, hyped up over fame. So what Marilyn liked that. She liked someone who wasn't going to, you know, just make her feel anything but comfortable. Mm. She needed that break. She needed somewhere to go to. And she knew the Carter family was somewhat the type of family that was not going to judge her, was not going to just see her as a sex symbol. They were going to be like the real friends that you could just, you know, have your hair down and just, you know, talk to them and they'd be nice people.
It's funny, isn't it? When you hear young people saying when they grow up they want to be famous, you know, the idea of how wonderful it must be to be famous and for everybody fawning over you all the time and, oh, can I get you anything, and, oh, don't you look beautiful, and all that kind of attention all the time. It's really interesting when you speak to famous people or people who have met famous people, really famous people, I'm talking about the likes of Marilyn Monroe, and how so many of them say the times that they kind of value and appreciate the most is when they're with normal people and allowed to be normal and don't have to kind of make sure they're dressed perfectly and their hair is perfect and they have to think about what they're saying and whether they're smiling or not and if the cameras are on them. They just want to be able to relax. So I can totally get that.
Absolutely.
It's funny, isn't it? Because we wouldn't perceive that necessarily. We'd think, oh, how wonderful it must be to have the cameras on you all the time and to be everybody wanting to be with you and photograph you. But it's not the case, is it?
Oh, no, because, you know, Marilyn actually told Terry when Terry was going to USC just before Marilyn died and said, you know, I really do appreciate being famous, but sometimes it can be a burden. I just wish that people would leave me alone. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's nice to be wanted like this, but it can be a burden, you know, to have to constantly deal with people fawning all over you.
Yeah, definitely. And so Fred, the father of Terry, he was in a relationship with Marilyn for a while.
That's correct. It was from about 1948 to 1949. There are some books that say it ended in around Christmas 1948, but that's not true. And that's just, you know, what the books try to put their pieces together. Everybody reads the books and they try to, you know, correlate it with the books, but that's not a good way to go. You got to go to the source. Don't just go to the other books and try to come to some conclusion. So it was until the spring of 1949. In fact, they, sang a song together, How Wrong Can I Be, which was in The Shape of Water. You know, the Guillermo del Toro movie, which won Best Picture and Best Director. And they had to ask Terry's permission to put that in there because it was written by Fred Karger and Manny Klein on the trumpet and Marilyn Monroe as the vocals. And it was right after Ladies of the Chorus. And so it was a beautiful song. You can hear Marilyn's really gorgeous voice. And it was something that people hadn't heard until Guillermo del Toro's movie got put out there. And he asked permission to put that song in there.
Oh, wonderful. So when and why did your fascination of Marilyn Monroe happen? Because as I mentioned in the introduction, you've written a few books about her now.
Yes. The first book I picked up on Marilyn was by George Barris when they had Borders bookstores in Santa Monica. And I picked up his book, and it says there, I will always believe that Marilyn was murdered. And so I started to read some other books like Donald Spoto, and people were coming up with three different arguments. One, that she committed suicide. Two, that it was an accidental death. And three, that it was a murder. Now, we can rule out accidental death because the coroner himself in his own book said that it's too many drugs to accidentally take, you know, so that can't happen. There were enough drugs in her blood from the toxicology reports, you know, to kill three people, you know, so that's not an accident. Mm-hmm. So the coroner himself who did the autopsy, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, said that it's either a suicide or it's a murder. And he always said in his autopsies that you have to consider it a murder until it's proven otherwise. And so what's interesting is that he's always come out with probable suicide as his official report. But when he's spoken in private to two people I've spoken to, Jane Mansfield's press secretary, Raymond Strait, who was a good friend of Noguchi, and Caroline Barris, who was the daughter of George Barris, you know, those two people told me that in private to them, Dr. Thomas Noguchi said, I always believed it was murder, but I couldn't say that. They made me say that. It was a cover-up. They didn't even do a good job because they had the pills with the caps back on. If it was really a suicide, the pills would be all over the floor. It wouldn't be such a neat crime scene. I mean, it was obviously fixed. And so, and also he said you would expect to see undissolved capsules in her stomach. There was just 20 cc's of a brownish mucoid fluid with no there were no undissolved capsules in her stomach, not once. And yet the coroner, Theodore Kerfey, said that there were, supposedly she had swallowed 64 pills. Well, where did the 64 pills go? And Noguchi says, well, that can't happen unless it's a murder. And so the ambulance attendant who first got on the scene, you know, Pat Newcomb was this was Marilyn's publicist, and she directed James Hall, the ambulance attendant from Schaefer Ambulance, over to the guest cottage. And James Hall says, what's wrong with her? And Pat Newcomb says, I think she took some pills. So that directed James Hall to go smell Marilyn's mouth. And he noticed there was no odor of drugs near her mouth. Now, some people have hypothesized that maybe she broke down the pills into a liquid and she just drank the liquid and that's how she killed herself. But that couldn't have happened without the odor of pear appearing in her mouth. And James Hall said there was no odor of pear. It's like a fruity smell that emanates from the chlorohydrate. Mm. There were supposedly 17 chlorohydrates. But you see, the blood shows that there were approximately 47, you know, nebutals and 17 chlorohydrates. Not that she swallowed that amount. That's the equivalent that was in her blood. And so James Hall knew that she didn't swallow these pills, and there were no indications of vomit. When people like that, you know, they take that many pills, they throw up. Mm-hmm. But then her face was turning blue, and they got her in a resuscitator, and then all of a sudden Marilyn's psychiatrist comes in and says, I'm her doctor, pushes James Hall aside. And he injects this needle into her heart without diluting it with water first. That kills the patient within a minute. And then within a minute, Dr. Greenson says, I'm going to pronounce her dead. You can leave. And so that's how Marilyn died, you know, by this doctor, Dr. Greenson, pretending that he was trying to save her and he was really killing her.
Wow. So who is they? When you say the coroner was told, they told him that he had to say it was suicide. Who's they?
Theodore Kerfey, who was, you know, guided by Bobby Kennedy, and also the chief William Parker. They were all in a conspiracy to keep this thing quiet. They knew that all, you know, eyes would be on Bobby Kennedy. Daryl Gates, in his own, you know, the police chief Daryl Gates, in his own autobiography, he admitted that Robert Kennedy was in town secretly in Los Angeles on August 4th, 1962. You know, and all this time, you know, there was this lawyer named John Bates who says, oh, Bobby Kennedy never left San Francisco. Well, that contradicts that. And you got this police officer, Detective Lynn Franklin, who pulled over a car with Peter Lawford driving drunk, a Continental sedan, and he had his headlights off. He was on Olympic and Robertson Boulevard, which is 7 miles from Marilyn's house, at about 20 minutes after Greenson had injected her in the heart. And you have in the backseat Bobby Kennedy, because, you know, Franklin had recognized Bobby Kennedy. He had gone on security detail with him before, so he knew who Bobby Kennedy was. Not only that, but, you know, he said, why are you driving so fast, Pete? Because he knew him on first-name basis. And Pete says, oh, well, I got to get the attorney general here back to the airport so he can fly out of town. And then and Pete points to the guy in the front seat and he says, "Oh, that's a doctor. He's riding along with us." And Franklin later identified that doctor as Dr. Ralph Greenson from funeral footage that he saw later at the funeral a few days later.
Gosh. So the doctor that came in and injected her in the heart, what's his story then? Why would he have wanted to kill her?
According to Peter Lawford, what happened was, this is a very funny thing. Well, not funny, like ha-ha, but like kind of peculiar. What happened was that according to Peter Lawford in his last interview before he died, he said that Bobby had tricked Ralph Greenson. You see, Marilyn was going to hold a press conference exposing her affairs with Jack and Bobby Kennedy first thing Monday morning, the killer on Saturday. And she was going to expose national security secrets, like the, you know, bases in Cuba, the secret plot to kill Castro by the president, John Kennedy. And so they couldn't have her spilling these national security secrets. But, you know, what Bobby said to Greenson was, he called him up, according to Peter Lawford, and said, "Hey, look, Greenson, she's going to expose me and Jack on Monday morning, but she's also going to expose the affair that you're having with her, too." See, Marilyn was having an affair with Greenson, but she was not going to expose it, only Bobby and Jack. And so Bobby lied to Greenson to get rid of Marilyn. It scared him enough where he didn't have to get paid to do it. And he was, his whole psychoanalytic career, which he just was really burgeoning at that point, you know, he didn't want it to go up in smoke. And so he figured, well, here's this woman who's going to just ruin it for everybody. And so Bobby provided him with the needle. We know this because there were neighbors like Mary W. Goody Coons Barnes, who saw Bobby Kennedy earlier that day with a physician with a medical bag, you know, in his possession. And so, and we also know this because there's a police contact that said that Bobby Kennedy admitted in a deposition to Edward Davis, a police chief who later became police chief, that that Bobby Kennedy said, "Yes, we gave her an injection in the under her left arm, in an artery to calm her down in the afternoon." So that's what was in that medical bag, was, you know, a needle.
Yeah.
And so that's where the needle came from. It didn't come from Greenson himself. And there's actually a CIA document dated August 3rd, 1962, one day before Marilyn died, that we show in this book, in which it shows that Marilyn was going to hold a press conference. They know this because the CIA was tapping Bobby Kennedy and Marilyn's phone conversations. She said that she had her, what she referred to as her diary of secrets. So the Red Diary did exist. Not only that, but I interviewed a police officer, Mike Rothmiller, who also wrote a book, who saw the Red Diary. He saw pictures that were taken of it, and he made some certain notations that he thought were relevant. But it confirms everything that we think was in there. And also, she was going to, well, what the newspapers would do with such disclosures, she was going to threaten to expose the national security secret that President Kennedy was trying to kill Castro. And so, you know, they couldn't have any of this. And they felt that this was going to be a humongous scandal. It would ruin the presidency and it'd probably make a lot of people go to jail. So they just took care of it.
Gosh, it's unbelievable, isn't it? Well, well done for telling the story and getting the truth out there. And it really is an amazing story. There's lots of books that you've done about Marilyn Monroe. So if people go on to Amazon, if they put your name in, J. Margulies, then they can find the various books. But the latest one is My Marilyn, which was written in conjunction with Terry Carger. And that's available to buy on our website. Jay, thank you so much for joining us. Great to chat with you.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.